Welcome to another episode of Business and Stuff. And we've got a fantastic guest with us today. I'll pass over to him to introduce himself.
Hi, Pierre. Thanks for having me on. My name is Vincent Kashani. I'm the author of a historical novel called Iberian Claim that's going to be published this August. I'm also a university student at the University of California, San Diego. I'm graduating from there 2 years early this spring, and I'm majoring in international business.
So, interesting. I've had a bit of a look online at the book that you're writing at the moment. Tell me, you know, in your words, about the book, you know, perhaps a little bit of the story, and sort of what got you to sort of writing the book.
Yeah, so basically it's a true story about this Spanish expedition that fails, and they have to come to terms with the immorality of colonialism, because they're living amongst the people they plan to subjugate. They have to survive amongst these people. So, like all true stories, I basically found it online on a history website source. You know, not everybody finds it that way, but that's how I found it. I was 12 years old. I was in middle school, and I was doing a project on an early explorer, and I came across Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Baca. So a pretty loaded name, kind of made me laugh, honestly, and it caught my eye. And kind of naively, I went out and started writing a book based off that story. I spent that whole summer in 2014 writing 100 pages before I realized, darn, I really need to do some research. So I scrapped it and I started again. And little by little, it sort of grew into a passion project that became a part of my weekly routine, where I'd work on it on weekends. I'd work on it on weekdays after class and homework, and then I work on it over the summers. So it was definitely a spread out project that took me a while to complete.
How would you go about researching something like that? Being that it's a story in history, how would you go about kind of researching that? It's difficult. Did you go to the library and sort of look at all the, you know, the writing on that subject, around that story? I mean, if someone was writing a book similar to, you know, to yourself, I mean, where would they go to? I mean, what was the process of research for you?
That's a really good question. And I think in retrospect, there are a lot of things I actually would have done differently, because I started out this process very young and I sort of relied on a few sources that I had available to me. I had obviously the internet available to me, and that was sort of my main source initially. And then I found out that this main protagonist of this expedition had written an account. And so from there, I read his account, I dissected it little by little, and that sort of became my main primary source for my book. And it'd be different if I was writing a nonfiction history book, you know, historical nonfiction book, because I'd have to thoroughly research any and everything that I said. Any and everything that I say in the book has to be historically accurate. But with historical fiction, and especially being somebody who's, you know, only an undergraduate and is not a professor in the subject, doesn't have any societal expertise on that area of history, I get to say this is a historical fiction book, and I get to play with that. I get to be creative with that. I get to add dialogue. I get to add a few events. I get to craft what happened in history into a story and have a message at the end of all of it. So ultimately, I had a few key sources that I relied on, but I did not have to research, you know, going like the image of going around to the different libraries. I did not have to dig in as hard as maybe somebody who's doing a nonfiction book.
If it's a nonfiction book, you know, it has to be, like you say, all the facts have to be checked and everything like that. And I think that the exciting thing actually about taking a story that's happened in the past in history and doing it within a novel, it gives you the way, it allows you to interpret it as you would imagine. And I think the exciting thing about that is, you know, if you look at film, for example, I know it's a different thing entirely, but being able to, in film, you know, just as you can in a book, to be able to take what the director sees, or, you know, the screenwriter, how they see the past, and to really elaborate and give their view of it, really by doing that, it excites the, you know, the viewer, and they're sort of, you're almost romanticizing it, aren't you? And it just, it makes people passionate about history, because, you know, you can really enrich a story. I mean, in terms of that, that process, how do you take that story and then sort of apply, you know, a creative view of the story? I mean, is it something that you had a process to do?
Definitely. That's well, to me, it was different things at different times. But what it's become is actually a mix of the survival aspect that initially hooked me when I was younger. And then over the years, what I found out to be the most important aspect of the book, which is what it says about colonization and colonialism. What that story, it's a counter to the types of narratives we receive, especially in the States, about Christopher Columbus, you know, sailing the ocean blue in 1492 and everything being a-okay. It sort of counters that with a more authentic story about these people who are faced with what's actually going on and what's actually happening to people and human beings at the time. And a lot of it's horrible. A lot of it's terrible stuff. But they're discovering that in the same way a Spaniard would at that time. You know, they are Christopher Columbus wannabes who have to go and are faced with the consequences of what they're wanting to do. And I think that authenticity, that aspect to it, is the most important part that drives the story in a different way than you would maybe see it in a, you know, a cold, hard, factual representation of that history. Because it's hard to get that to shine through without interaction between the characters, without that development, that character arc over the story. I think that's a really big one. So what you're asking about the character development is certainly, it's a tricky thing to develop, but it's the most fun thing to develop. And it's definitely the most important in moving along a story that sends that message.
I mean, in terms of the story, the true story, as you say, not necessarily being a really commonly known story. I mean, do you think that the history books that we're sort of taught in school, do you think really they focus on certain events to kind of build a sort of a naive narrative, whereas there's a lot of history that we don't know that perhaps would make us think differently? Would you say there is a lot of history which is sort of secret?
Definitely. Yes, definitely. That's a really good way of putting it too, a secret history, because, you know, for whatever reason, you know, these narratives are built up and they benefit certain people and they're driven by certain people. But all that aside, you're missing very big, we as listeners and learners are missing big pieces of history that flesh out a lot of the different things going on at these times, because it's not just Columbus, it's not just Hernan Cortez who are going in and decimating native populations and then being, you know, good, having good things said about them afterwards. There are these people who are failures ultimately, who don't get their story told, who kind of have a change of heart in a lot of meaningful ways. And those stories aren't usually told per se because maybe they didn't have the biggest impact on history overall. Maybe because this expedition failed, you know, the people who are telling history don't feel the need to say this story. But I think in terms of emotional aspects of history and the interpersonal aspects between most people at the time, a story like this shows a lot more than the glossed over, romanticized, you know, conqueror stories, or, you know, these heroic legendary stories that we hear that have a lot of dark, seedy stuff that's kind of pushed beneath the surface.
I mean, would you say that perhaps we need to know more of the failure stories and perhaps not just, you know, the conquered this, conquered that area? Do you think that there needs to be a lot of the sort of untold history? I mean, do you think it's important for us to kind of get a more rounded historical education as opposed to just the major events and the major points, as you say?
Yes, I definitely would agree with that. I think it's more important for us to be able to hear a lot of these different stories that flesh things out and But I also would say it's more interesting for a lot of people, because I know from my own experience, I hear about this glossed over version of a conqueror tale, and it's very impersonal. It's very, this happened, so all these things came after it, and it's a super important year in the world's history. You hear that and you kind of put it in the back of your head and go, okay, well, I know about that now. I don't really need to connect with it or worry about it. It doesn't really affect me. But if you're able to tell a more personalized tale of truth, really, between people at various different times, it's easier for students and younger students especially to relate to it. And if you're telling these stories in an actual story form, in an actual book form or a film or, you know, a podcast series or even songs, like, you know, like Hamilton, the way Hamilton personalized that story was really powerful, I think, for a lot of students. If you can do that with multiple different stories in history, whether or not they're successes or failures, I think it will bring up a lot of important ways of thinking about what's gone on in the past and how it actually continues today. Because there's a lot from 500 years ago when this Alvar Nunez expedition happened that still kind of has its roots in the world today. And you can look back and see why those specific events were really important, even though they're not talked about too much.
Definitely. And in terms of making history more sort of relevant, well, not necessarily relevant, that's probably the wrong word, more kind of accessible to people of today. I mean, so many generations are, you know, I mean, my generation, your generation, certainly growing up in the era of technology, you know, of AI, you know, AI, artificial intelligence, and, you know, there's so many changes, really. We're almost in a different revolution, sort of, you know, there was the Industrial Revolution, but now we're in almost in an AI revolution where things are going to change. And I think this will be a time that we look back, you know, in history as quite a monumental time, hopefully not a terrible time. Hopefully AI won't take us to a disastrous destination. But I mean, you know, how can history be more relatable to the youth of today when it seems so black and white and so separated from the reality that we know today?
You know, I think people in the past and a lot of ways of telling certain parts of history have kind of dumbed down things for children or for younger students or even students in secondary education. And I think kids relate, and people in general relate to stories that they can see themselves in. So when you flesh that out in that way, and you bring in the sort of innocent things too that are appealing from the get-go, like me with this book, the first thing that caught me about it was, oh, it's a survival story. Oh my gosh, I'm sitting here in my classroom on my computer, and 500 years ago, these people walked across southern North America naked over the course of a decade with no map, no way of understanding where they're going, having to live off the land, learn a bunch of languages all at once. That's a survival story. And that's super interesting to people who really want to get out of their houses, who really want to go do things. I really want to go do things. I'm tired of the online school and all these sorts of things. So I can only imagine when these kinds of these tales and these stories, true stories, come across people's desks or, you know, into somebody's house, and they fall in love with that aspect of it, because that's just exciting on a face value. And then the depth comes in when you can actually talk about, okay, here's why this, you know, survival story or adventure story or war story, even, what have you, is really important today. Here's why. And if you can do those at the same time, I think a lot of people can get on board with that.
Definitely. And so now looking at, you know, the kind of the process of writing a book, I actually wrote a book recently called Think It, Pitch It, Sell It. It's a sort of a business book, but it was a completely, thank you. It was a completely sort of new process to me. You know, I'd never sort of written a book before. I'd tried to, you know, I started and I stopped, and I found my my sort of way of doing it, you know, my way of sort of, you know, breaking it down into chapters. But I mean, what was your process, you know, and how would you, you know, explain to any budding authors how you could go about writing a book? I mean, did you break it down into chapters, or what was your process?
Well, you know, that's great that you bring that up, because breaking it down into chapters and outlining it in retrospect, those are amazing ways to write a book. But like a lot of things when I was starting this, I was extremely naive and I just went for it immediately. You know, I had this kind of spark and I just took it and rolled with it. And I must have started and restarted the book probably tens of times. I probably had 30 different first chapters. I could never get farther than that. And I kept going over and over again. And I eventually came to this point where I realized I need to break things down a little bit more. And I'm lucky in that historical fiction gives you kind of an avenue to say, here's the historical events and here's how you can synthesize them into a story. A lot of people don't have that when they're writing fiction or nonfiction, like with your book. There's no outline inherently there to tell you what to do. You have to make it yourself. So my job was to take what I had seen in history and what I was reading and researching and to form that into a pretty rough outline. It wasn't very specific. And little by little, they kind of morphed into chapters and worked themselves out. And then now I'm even editing still with my publisher now and an editor, which is super helpful and great. And it's still refining that outline and fitting the story arc into these chapters in a different way than when I had started. So if I were to ever write another book, I would definitely start at that point and work from there. And it probably would have saved me a few years, but yeah, it worked out.
I think that's half the fun, isn't it? Sort of, you know, ultimately when you get to the end of writing the book, you know, it feels great. And, you know, at the beginning of the, you know, the process, you know, you think, okay, I have to write, you know, 60 to, you know, 100,000 words. And it's like, wow, it's a big number, you know, and sort of getting there, you know, is an amazing thing. A question actually that comes to mind, obviously you're very passionate about history. And you know, of course that comes over. But how do you think history can help with present day problems and perhaps even with future events? I mean, how relevant do you think history is in terms of helping us solve problems that we have today and in the future?
That's a very good question. And that's great you ask that, because I didn't start this book at all thinking about that. But as time has gone on, I'm definitely thinking about it a lot more. And one of the key things is really just on the face value, Native American rights, right off the bat, at least with this specific story. You know, there's a lot that we don't talk about, a lot of tragedy and a lot of things that have happened, but a lot that's still going on. And I think the more stories you tell that highlight that or talk about how that's a thing, really, and still is, then it can only be helpful if you do it in the right ways and do it in a respectful way. And I think a lot of different stories that are worth telling have that same feature of importance for a different issue. And even if somebody's not thinking about it, if they chip away enough at a lot of the different stuff going on in their brain or with their story, they can kind of find that pretty easily, because there are a lot of problems in society and there are a lot of things to fix. And even more, you know, less social problems, there are business problems that need to be fixed. There are political problems that need to be fixed that are different than, you know, rights issues. So I think a lot of books, if they can find that and keep that as a presence in their story, maybe not the only feature, that's super valuable. And it will help both ways. It will help people read the book more, but also help the book do more.
Definitely. I mean, you know, you say obviously that there's still problems today. I mean, if you look at the news, I mean, certainly there in the States, there seems to be a great deal of inequality and perhaps maybe even sort of racial tension in some ways. Oh, I mean, looking through the eyes of someone who's passionate about history, and someone perhaps in, you know, in your sort of generation, what's the answer? I mean, what can we perhaps learn from history, to apply to now? I mean, is there, is there ways that that we can push for more equality and that we can deal with sort of racial tension? Or is it a problem? Do you think it's a problem that's just always been there and perhaps always will be there to some degree? I mean, what do you think is the answer sort of trying to use history as a teacher?
That's a great point. Great question. I think for me personally, I look at a story and like this one, that's sort of a secret history, like you said. And I think the first place to start is with replacing or reshaping what we're taught and what we're told in a way that's accurate and honest. I think that's the most important thing, from my opinion, that you can do right off the bat. Beyond that, there are tons more problems, and I'm not skilled enough or adequate enough to solve or even know solutions for many of them. But I do think that's a great place to start. And I also think that looking back and seeing the ways people could have done things differently in different situations, just by learning from what they did wrong, you can see when those similar situations pop up in your own life, you can respond the right way. Enough people can respond the right way to make things at least better. And a great example, even from the book, is the main characters, their arc. The main character in particular is starting out wanting to be the next conqueror, wanting to destroy and claim. That's where the claim in the title, Iberian Claim, comes from. He's wanting to claim this land as his own. And he slowly realizes all the problems with that, lesson by lesson and little by little. And he makes tons of mistakes along the way, and he does terrible things along the way. But ultimately coming to that place of, here's why I was wrong in those situations, and here's how I can at least push for that better outcome and better responses from other people, that's a great thing that we all can do.
Definitely. Also, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the book called The Fourth Turning. It's a really interesting book, actually. I mean, I've only recently become aware of it, but it focuses on what's called the Strauss-Howe generational theory, also known as the fourth turning theory, or simply the fourth turning. And it describes the theorized recurring generational cycle in American history and in world history, I guess, as well, where there's sets of decades and generations and that they sort of repeat in a cycle. And so really time is almost repeating itself in many ways. Do you think history has a tendency to, you know, to repeat itself in many ways because of, you know, obviously the sort of, you know, the average person lives to what, sort of 70, 80 years old. And there's lots of different generations that are sort of, within a sort of a, you know, a couple of decades, you know, and everybody has their life span. And do you think that a few decades over the course of, I think the book actually says five different generations, do you think that history does have a way of repeating itself in some ways?
That's a fascinating concept. I'll definitely have to read that book now that you bring it up. I would agree. I would certainly agree with that. And I don't know exactly the scale they're saying that happens on, but I would almost argue that from what I've seen and at least researched, I would think it happens almost on a larger scale, that I think we're still in the cycle of this past 500 years of things that have been done early on in that cycle affecting what's going on today. I really do, because you look at how much these people who colonized different areas, not just North America, but all over the world, how much these people, nations, but even more specifically people and groups of people benefited from that just outright, and how that trickles down little by little, generation by generation, into lots of different issues. Lots of income inequality is one, but societal inequality, all these sorts of issues can be tied back to those kinds of actions really easily. And yes, the effects are slowly starting to be peeled away, and there's more equality happening in different ways where it hasn't before, but you still see it. And you can still point back to that point right there. That's where it started, or that's where it happened. And it's still going on. It's still trickling down.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, in terms of sort of, you know, sort of world politics, if you like, I mean, let's hope that it's not the situation. But I mean, do you think there's certain powers or certain, you know, countries that are still looking to conquer, you know, to use a sort of almost a, well, hopefully sort of a historical thought, you know, of conquering sort of places and sort of taking on, you know, sort of, you know, conquering different countries. I mean, do you think that, I mean, for example, you know, the likes of it, it's always in the news, isn't it? But Russia and China and all these sort of major powers. I mean, do you see over the next few decades, you know, there being a lot of change, or do you think that it's mostly just the news? And I mean, or do you think that there is some possibilities that, again, you know, perhaps time can have this this terrible repeating process of, you know, people needing to, you know, to emit power out and you know, to sort of, you know, conquer new territories and grow their existing kingdom, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, I would definitely say it's still going on today. And I would say, though, it's changed forms. And a lot of the dynamics, from what I can tell, have changed. Going back 500 years, especially to this, you know, specific expedition or these series of expeditions at this time, you look at who's chartering them, who's allowing these expeditions to happen, who's pushing them. And you can say, oh, it's a lot of the royal families. It's not necessarily these nations themselves who are outright, you know, villains doing these things. But you have different backers doing it with different interests. And I would almost say, following that model of, you know, political unions getting behind a specific conquistador or explorer or expedition, you kind of have similar business relationships or political relationships nowadays that are going on that back certain actions for various reasons. And we may know a lot of them, and sometimes you're not always clued into all the facts that are going on about why people do certain things or why they have certain interests. But I would say a very prominent example from today would be, I think the term is neocolonialism in the entire continent of Africa, really, in various places over the continent, and especially like with what's going on in Ethiopia right now, with just outright abuse of workers and materials and the land. And it's changed form, and there's a lot of justification that's different now, and there's a lot of global networks and organizations that legitimize certain actions. And a lot of that is great and good, and I'm not saying that's bad, but I'm saying there are new loopholes and ways that people have found out how to do it. And I don't think it's always, per se, one country going into the border of another country, although you still see that too. But I think it's changed. I think the people who want to keep power and do those sorts of things have figured out the right tools to do that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how do you think technology affects politics? How would you think that technology affects politics these days? And, you know, back obviously in time, you know, within your story, for example, 500 years ago, there wasn't technology, you know, that we had, you know, well, there wasn't technology like we have today. Do you think that technology has created a huge change? Of course, you know, you've got, and I've mentioned this in one of my podcasts before, but, you know, the US politics, you know, sort of system has certainly seemingly or you know, it's said to have been affected somewhat in terms of, you know, the likes of social media platforms putting out, you know, fake news and everything like that. I mean, do you think that that's something that's here to stay? And you know, do you also think that they had that kind of thing back in the day, but not in the form of technology, you know, propaganda in different ways? I mean, how do you think the technology is changing the future?
You know, I do see technology as obviously a really great tool. And it's a tool like any tool that can be used for good or evil. You know, whatever that means to you or whatever that means to whoever's listening, there are definitely good things that can be done and bad things. And I think like with the steam engine, or you can go back in early in the Industrial Revolution, those tools can be used for a lot of good and getting food out to lots of different people and other things like that. But they can also be used for evil in making, you know, big warships, you know, more powerful and more powerful weapons and all and yada, yada, yada. But technology in right now with our AI revolution and all these, the technological revolution that's going on, the same sort of thing is happening. And I think people are figuring out which ways it can be used for good and which ways it can be used to leverage different decisions and to ultimately do some bad things as well. I think it is here to stay. I think the convenience of a lot of different things, and even like with colleges, with online school, I think that's here to stay as well. Maybe not completely online, but I think it's so convenient for different institutions to be able to use technology to, you know, better business or just function more efficiently and more and easier. But I think the same problems, the same people who don't quite have that access to the technology or aren't quite able to get their hands on the right tools are still going to be the ones who are negatively affected by the decisions made by the people who are able and do have the opportunity to use these tools. So I do think it's changed form, and people are obviously more literate and people are more aware of different things going on, but you know, fake news, people can still be tricked. People can still be told lies. And it's hard to fact check things when your other source is also an online source. And it's hard. It's confusing to people. So propaganda has definitely taken a different form, but that is a very powerful tool as well, as you bring up.
Yeah. And to a different subject now, you know, one that we're all sort of living through, and that's the pandemic. I mean, what's your take on the pandemic as a student in California? How's it affected student lives, and how might it, you know, sort of change the future in many ways? Like you said, you know, with online learning now and things like that. I mean, how's it directly affected you, for example, and you know, your fellow students?
Right. So it definitely came as a shock initially, and everybody kind of got adjusted to it. But after that happened, you know, this was sort of the new normal, and this was the hand we were dealt, and there's a lot of cons associated with it. There are definitely more cons than pros for students. The cons are the cost is still the same of going to school. You're receiving an online education at basically the same cost. You aren't having the same access to networking and connections that you're normally getting when you go in person to these events. You aren't seeing the same friends. You aren't going in person to the classes and sitting next to them and building relationships. And it can lead to a lot of bad habits in terms of, you know, mental health and physical health and all these sorts of things. And it's really hard to overcome those. On the flip side, there are a few pros. It's a lot easier to get more things done, I would say, personally. And I think that's sort of the philosophy I've taken with it, is I've been dealt a hand that I have no control or power over. I can't change the situation I'm in. What am I going to do with that? Well, my situation was the things I wanted out of college, I'm not really getting anymore. I'm not getting that networking and connections. The learning I was receiving has been significantly impacted by the way it's being taught. And for me, it's not the best method of learning. Personally, I don't like learning this way very much. But I still need to get my name on a diploma. I still need the legitimacy of graduating from college to get a good job, or if I'm starting my own business, or, you know, writing as a career, which is hopefully what I can do, I need that legitimacy behind me, I feel like. for what I'm doing. So my strategy was to get through college faster, to use the pro of, okay, online school, we can take classes a little bit easier. It's a little bit easier to pack it all in and double speed the videos and do these sorts of things. My job in this, as I saw it, was to get done as quickly as possible and get the benefits out of college that I needed to get, because, you know, universities are expensive. They're very, very expensive. And so I needed to get the most out of it as quickly as possible.
Definitely. Yeah. It's I think there's been a lot of changes, but I think, yeah, if there is a positive that comes from it, I think it does allow you to, you know, to use your time more efficiently to get more done. And, you know, it definitely lets you think in a different way. But I think, you know, when the whole pandemic's over, I think everybody's going to be networking, meeting friends. And I think that the positive that I can take, you know, from all this, all these lockdowns and everything like that, is that it gives us the opportunity to see life and not sort of, I mean, in the past, it's easy to take things for granted, isn't it? And
oh, definitely.
Now, you know, there's that opportunity to see life with kind of fresh eyes, so to speak. So what's next for you? So you're studying international business,
yes,
as you said, and you've got the book coming out. I mean, what's the long-term goal? Did you say to be a long, you know, sort of like an author sort of full-time, or what is the main goal for you, think?
Yeah, you know, I'm open to a lot of different things in the general realm of storytelling. And I think what business has really done for me is help me take that kind of artsy, creative passion and make it more realistic and give me the skills to turn that into something that's marketable and into something that I know how to use in the workplace and in the, you know, any industry that I enter. So, you know, kind of dialing it back a little bit with even the way that the book I'm writing right now is getting published is very unique and cutting edge in what my publisher is doing, because just like in all creative industries right now, things have really changed in terms of the means of distribution. People going towards streaming in, you know, film, TV, podcasts and music, obviously on Spotify. The publishing industry is experiencing something similar. So the people who want to publish books are often choosing self-publishing and going through Amazon and Barnes and Noble's websites, which are now allowing that to be something that's available to anyone who's writing a book. Normally, those big booksellers are locked up to people who are, you know, average Joes like myself, because I'm, you know, other than a few hundred Instagram followers, nobody really knows who I am. So why is a publisher going to take a risk on somebody they can't guarantee is going to sell books for them when they know there are other people who are going to sell books for them? So what this new publisher, the New Degree Press, who is my publisher, what they've done is realized that that's a need that authors are lacking in. Like, they're not getting that need met. So how they're meeting that need is by providing, as a publisher, the legitimacy that a publisher brings, but with the tools and with the ease of use and with the openness and accessibility that somebody who's self-publishing would have. So, yeah, I could go more into the business model of that if you're interested, but that's sort of what I'm looking at that and thinking, how can I apply that same thinking that they're using in their industry to what I eventually enter in storytelling?
Definitely. So you're seeing in many ways, you know, an industry which is maybe becoming kind of stagnant, and you know, you're seeing what can be sort of done differently. And it's great that your publisher's sort of thinking differently as well, because there is a huge sort of emergence of you know, sort of authors online, sort of using all these sort of online, you know, self-publishing sort of platforms and everything. And it's yeah, it's interesting to know that, you know, your publisher's doing something different. And I think you know, a lot comes with being with a, you know, a publisher as opposed to, you know, doing it you know, yourself. So yeah, things are definitely changing. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. If people are, you know, people listening are keen to reach out to you, and I mean, what platforms are you on? Are you on LinkedIn, Facebook? I mean, what are your social platforms? And also, where can they look to get your book, and when does it come out?
Yeah, so thank you too, Pierre. It's been great being on here. But so I'm on Instagram. It's Vincent Kashani, just straight up my name. on Facebook, I'm vincent.kashani.3. And you can find me on LinkedIn through the same name. Also, with accessing the book, right now, one of the more inventive aspects of my publisher is a pre-sale focus. And right now, I'm in that pre-sale phase. So that's available until May 2nd on Indiegogo. If you type in the title of the book, Iberian Claim, on Indiegogo.com, you'll see that pre-sale focus that I'm launching until May 2nd. After that, no worries. If you're still interested in reading the book beyond that date, it will be published in August on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and you'll be able to have that book in your hands in September.